Hey, what's going on, guys? Welcome back to the Mike Force Podcast. It is your host, Mike G. Have Chad Robichaud, Task Force 68, Mighty Oaks Foundation, and one of the most incredible human beings that I know. Him, Tim Kennedy, Nick, a whole bunch of good guys from our little network traveled to Afghanistan as a non-government organization through the UAE and rescued over 8,000 Afghans. Got sent to UAE, a partner of ours in Abu Dhabi, and he tells the story and outlines it. There's a lot of misinformation out there, disinformation about this whole experience and what happened, and that's why we did this podcast. He was in the studio. So before I kick it off, this podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. There's something interfering with your happiness or preventing your goals. You're likely suppressing it and not talking about. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. And again, it's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional therapy securely online. Broad range of expertise. This service is available for clients worldwide. You know how if you shop for somebody like a therapist in your local community, that could be not be the right person. Well, the ability to do it online, you'll get a timely response. You could schedule weekly video or phone sessions, and you don't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches. It's more affordable than traditional offline therapy, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp today. If you start living a happier life today, visit their website, betterhelp.com/MikeForce. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/MikeForce, and join the over 1 million people now who have taken charge of their own mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional therapists all over the 50 states of the United States of America. Today, for the special offer, if you use MikeForce, at betterhelp.com/MikeForce, you can get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/MikeForce. Also, this podcast is sponsored by athleticgreens.com. Man, I went on a pretty adventurous hunt with Mark Warnke, and it was epic. You know, backcountry elk hunting is one of the hardest things that you could do. And the fact that I was able to take out and hike out Athletic Greens in my pack was amazing. Look, Athletic Greens has all the vitamins and essential minerals that you need, 75 included, that covers your full nutritional basis, but packed with vitamin C, zinc, probiotics, all the superfood stuff that you need to maintain good gut health and healthy aging. So when I traveled on my elk hunt, I used the Athletic Greens 5 travel packs that I got with my subscription. So right now, if you go to athleticgreens.com/MikeForce. That's athleticgreens.com/MikeForce. You can get a free year supply of vitamin D, which I also bring because it's in tincture form, and 5 travel packs with subscription that I use. Look, I get the subscription because I constantly use this, and I use it to break fast. And look, I'm on the go constantly. Time is money for me. And if I need all the nutritional supplementation, if I try to translate that into food, I could never get it. So athleticgreens.com/MikeForce, get a free year supply of vitamin D plus 5 travel packs with the subscription. All right, Chad Robichaud, guys, let's kick it off. Hey, Chad, thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks, brother.
Hey, so you can't talk about while you're in Utah, can you?
That's no.
Okay. Well, let's talk about, I mean, there's so much to talk about. I'm tired this morning, and actually when I was getting up this morning to come in here, because I've been in the woods for 4 days.
Getting that monster elk.
Yeah, when coming out of the woods, I'm like exhausted. And then I thought about you, and I'm like, why are you can't even feel sorry for yourself. Because if I'm tired, I know you got to be tired, because you've been doing something over the last several weeks where you're not getting any sleep, where you're just grinding away. And here you are. I mean, here you are.
I'm in that mode. You know, you've been there before where you just kind of like something like after like 2 days of it, just something flips and you just kind of feel great, you know?
Yeah. You're on autopilot.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So let's take it back a little bit. One, Chad has been on the podcast before with me, on the Philcraft Survival podcast, good friend, him and his family, MMA professional fighter, Force Recon Marine veteran, special operations project manager for special projects for JSOC, runs Mighty Oaks Foundations, which is a Christian-based organization that helps veterans, first responders, the people that are affected with PTSD and trying to navigate their lives. And it's a faith-based organization, but also therapy of 5 days, kind of off-grid, getting all the help they need, right?
Yeah, and getting plugged in to support, good aftercare, peer support, peer-to-peer support.
Yeah, got a podcast, got a book, the author of several books.
Yeah.
And man, just an amazing dude. And you, rewinding a little bit, how did this whole thing start with this Afghanistan piece? How did this start kind of bubbling?
Yeah, a little selfishly, to be honest with you. You know, we all have our interpreters that we served with over there. And, you know, mine was, you know, not unlike some people's experience, but probably a little bit unique in the fact that, you know, at JSOC in my task force, I was AFO, so as advanced force operator. And for those who don't understand what that is, it's, you know, going forward and doing the clandestine logistics to really put your assaulters on targets to capture, kill bad guys, and then building all the contingency plans in place for, you know, anything that could go wrong or what would go wrong, you know, building all that in place, local national vehicles and houses and safe houses and cash and blood and, you know, everything that you need to, you know, do a good clandestine operation. That's what AFOs do. And you often work with, you know, one other teammate, maybe two. And sometimes you work alone with a local national. And so in my situation with, you know, real quickly, I found myself working alone with this individual. I've in my books and before I've called him Bashir because I've protected his identity. And now today I could call him Aziz by his real name. And you know, so Aziz and I did 8 deployments together. And, you know, when we go out and do operations in the mountains of the Fada and, you know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, or the back alleys of those towns, when we were done with our operations, I didn't go back on a base and he went away. I went to his home, like I lived in his home with his family and made dinner with his kids and his wife and played soccer with his kids. And, you know, it was like my family when I was there. And, you know, if you accumulate my time, my 8 deployments, it's, you know, years of my life that I spent with this guy. And we became very close, very trusty, saved my life on multiple occasions. He saved my friends' lives. I've seen him save, he put his life in harm's way to go do, you know, clandestine QRF, so to speak, of SEALs that needed us to get him out. And he just always put his life out of the way. And, you know, he would always, if there was a corner to walk around, then there was no way I was allowed to walk around that corner first. He was going to go first, no matter what. And, you know, he's just an amazing human being. And we became friends over the years. We stayed in touch. When my son Hunter went to Afghanistan and he found who was going, he's like, hey, Uncle Aziz is here to protect him, you know? And it gave me a good feeling that my son was there in a country where Aziz was. And we've been trying to get his special immigrant visa through for about 6 years. And it's just a broken system. I mean, it's a guy who's like special operations, saved Americans' lives, done the most incredible like service to our country, fought as a patriot for his country, polygraph. Like, I mean, he's done his, we've done the due diligence on this guy to be able to become American. And if the SIV process didn't work for him, then I don't understand who it could work for.
Yeah, while thousands of people migrate across the border with absolutely no recourse.
We have no idea who they are.
Yeah.
And so when I seen, you know, President Biden say, give a date, you know, on the 20th anniversary, we're going to pull out. I was like, this is going to not go good. And I need to get my friend out of there. And so I reached out to Congresswoman Hartzler. Vicky Hartzler is a good friend of mine in Congress. She started helping to expedite his visa process. And that was my plan A. My plan B was to do it myself. Dan Stinson was one of the guys I worked for at JSOC, a former, you know, like we could say now he's done, you know, OGA and you may have worked with him there and you know, TF Orange and TF Blue, and he's like, you know, very, very experienced guy. And we said, hey, let's go get him. Let's put a plan together. So we came up with a plan, kind of clandestine plan, like our old days of how we're going to do it. A bunch of kind of old guys trying to dusting off, like the fat guy trying to fit back in a superhero suit, you know?
Yeah.
And let's go do this. And so we, as we started watching this thing deteriorate and seeing things go south, and we started hearing from Aziz about some of the interpreters being killed, being targeted and killed. Particularly, you know, one particular that we both worked with had his head cut off a couple of weeks ago. And so we knew we had to do it quick. And as he started moving his family every night, cause he was being looked for. And we kind of just pressed the pedal to the floor, and I put together a team of about, we got about 10 guys together, from special operations community. Some guys with a very high level experience, current level experience, not old timers like me, I learned so much from in the last few weeks that, you know, and, Tim Kennedy, we got Tim to come, wanted to get you out there with us. And, because you were like my first top of my call list, but, you know, put together this group of people and had the money. We got the money together, had a plan, but we knew we needed more support than we were able to get, you know, on our own. So we went to the UAE government. I wasn't allowed to say this up until just a few days ago. We went to the United Arab Emirates. So if anybody's been following me on my social media, I keep saying a country in the Middle East. I was being vague because we weren't allowed to say anything. And
what's changed since then to allow you to be able to say it now?
They released it. They allowed CNN to come there and release it. They were. The UAE allowed CNN to come there and
oh, okay.
Media. So they,
yeah,
they want to be the first to release it.
Okay. Got it.
And I think during the time they want to protect their relationship with the United States back a few weeks ago when they respected the United States.
Yeah.
You know, that's obviously
changed
dramatically. And, in the whole world, you know, I mean, so we, you know, we went to them and we went to the royal family. We had some connections with the royal family and we just said, hey, these people need help. We have the capacity and ability to help them. If we partner with you, we could pull this off. And we were able to convince them that we had the ability to do it. And they gave us about 5 generals to, as liaison, to have their military resources available to us. They gave us an airfield, on military base in Abu Dhabi. They let us set up a joint operations center in their command post. And they, gave us a humanitarian center and then the access to military aircraft and ability to use their runway and air crews. For charter aircraft. And so we,
when you say, so just sort of context for people.
Yeah.
You say we, so you came in there, you had points of contact, obviously.
Yeah.
From, your network and special operations with the generals. And by the way, just some further context, the UAE, the United Arab Emirates have been working hand in hand with America since the beginning of the global war on terror.
Yes.
And they're one of the few countries that haven't faltered in that. I mean, Saudi Arabia has faltered. Other countries in the area, Qatar has faltered. UAE has always been committed to the cause, right?
Yeah.
So you got, when you say we, you mean your organization.
Yeah. I mean, me and 10 of my friends.
That's, that's crazy.
I think Tim put a post, Tim Kennedy put a post out a while back to Mitt Romney, like, hey, give me a plane and 12 of my best friends and we'll get it done. And that's actually literally what we did.
Yeah.
We just got some of our friends and went up and showed up over there and we're like,
yeah,
hey, we're going to do this. You want to help? And they were like, yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and 2 weeks later, you know, in 8 days on the ground in Afghanistan, we rescued 8,911 people, assisted, with another 3,000 people. So we got 12,000 people out of Afghanistan and safely to humanitarian center in Dubai, but and the humanitarian center in Abu Dhabi. By the way, they had only given us 4,100 beds, so we overshot a little bit.
Yeah,
But we were telling one of the generals, I'm like, hey, we could be like fast. We could have quality.
Yeah.
Or we could have accuracy. But we can't have all three.
Yeah.
That's
awesome.
Kind of like a shooting principle, right?
Yeah. Well, so a lot of people. So when you go and do something like this, let's talk about the reason a lot of this stuff happened in the first place, because you have some understanding being there on the ground. We have a timeline that's set.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, which I've told people before, as a sergeant major in special operations, especially that work for JSOC and the commander's extremist force for specific continents, mine was the Middle East and Africa. I've planned NEO operations before. I did the planning evacuation. I was the representative for the planning and evacuation of all American citizens out of Mali when Mali was falling apart. And a couple guys from DevGuru, a couple guys from different units, we did a planning session and came up with a course of action development that later became the evacuation plan or crisis plan of action. And when you do that, that's typically a military operation because you need military assets, logistical support. And you already have military on the ground,
mm-hmm.
so they facilitate, and they have the tactical competency to understand the situation.
Yeah.
In this case, it was very different.
Very different. And for those who don't know what a NEO is a non-combatant evacuation operation. I mean, non-combatant meaning civilians. Before I answer that, I just want to give some context to how we ended up there to need a NEO operation. And many people won't agree with me on this, but so, you know, hear me out. We were not in a 20-year war. Mm. We were not in endless war. We've been conditioned to believe it so much that we're, I've even heard some, you know, conservative news media people and even, you know, conservative political leaders saying like, oh, it was endless war. We had to get out. You know, this was just a blunder on how we got out. The truth is we were in a 20-year war. The war was over 3 years ago when President Trump started dropping mobs on people. We had 2,500 on average to 4,000 troops at Bagram Air Force Base supporting the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police, the ANA and ANP, to fight the Taliban and keep it that fight on their own soil. The entire international community, the Germans, the French, the British, the Georgians, all, you know, South Koreans, Canadians, everybody from around the world was using Bagram Air Force Base as an international hub to fight global terrorism on their soil, and it was working. The United States was just participating in that. We were not in a sustained war with the Taliban. We were supporting and advising the Afghan National Army with only 4,000 troops. Bagram Air Force Base is, in today's current world, is the most strategic location on the planet. It sits between Iraq, Iran, Russia, China, Syria. I mean, everybody in the world wants that place. And the international community had it. It wasn't ours to give away. And we did it without consent of the international community, without consulting with them, without even talking to the Afghan government. We did it between the White House and the Taliban. And so to leave Afghanistan, I think is the lie that we've all been conditioned to believe that we should. But when you contrast 2,500 to 4,000 troops in Afghanistan, as opposed to the 80,000 troops in Japan since World War II, the 40,000 troops in Germany since World War II, the 30,000 troops in South Korea since the Korean War, why was it so important that we make this pullout and so abruptly and the White House is so passionate about it? You have to think who has anything to gain from it. Mm-hmm. And we're the only people that really have anything to gain from it is besides the Taliban, of course, is China. In fact, China and Russia's embassies didn't even close during any of this. They stayed open.
Of course.
China, I've been saying this for months, and people would have said I was a conspiracy theorist if you had heard me months ago saying this. But China wanted the U.S. out of there because they want the international, they want the mineral rights for the Hindu Kush because lithium and stuff in the mountains, there's trillions of dollars. And I was saying this, and then on September 1st, the day after we pulled out, the Taliban and China made a deal for those mineral rights in the Hindu Kush mountains. So that's the why. And the way, after the why, which we shouldn't have did it, the way that we did it was the debacle. So one, I believe, was very intentional. The other was a debacle. The debacle was we pulled out the military before the civilians. We got rid of our major airfield, Bagram Air Force Base, to evacuate our equipment and our people before we pulled out civilians. That was a major mistake. In fact, when, you know, and I've been in this room before, and you probably have too, a room full of like Air Force guys watching satellites and seeing people come across that border, seeing the 75,000 Taliban surging in, right? We would have known that they were coming. We knew that our equipment was on the ground, $85 billion in equipment. By the way, the Taliban now is in the top 15% of militaries in the world that have
just fallen into it.
Yeah, that have helicopters. And so when the military saw this happening, when CENTCOM saw this happening, their response was to send the 82nd Airborne to re-seize the Bagram Airfield. That's what they do, right? And to make sure they hold it for our equipment and us to have an evacuation route. And the White House shut that down. That's not a conspiracy. That's actually fact. President Biden and General Milley have already admitted to that they stopped the 82nd Airborne from seizing that airfield and holding it for us. They didn't think we needed it. And so now you truly have a scenario that creates what we were talking about, a non-combatant evacuation that needs to take place. That operation belongs to the military. As you said, usually JSOC or SOCOM kind of leads that effort to evacuate people. It was such a big effort. We knew we had between probably 10,000 and 30,000 Americans on the ground. That's a conservative number to a very, you know, unknown number because we don't know how many people were there. State Department doesn't track that. It's the individual responsibility to register if you travel to another country. So State Department didn't know how many people were there. But we know at least 10,000 and 80,000 allies that had to get moved through this NEO operation. The White House took the NEO operation away from the military where it belongs, where it's traditionally where they're equipped to do it, they have the experience to do it, and they gave it to the State Department, who has no idea how to do it. It'd be like me and you go and take a job as a software engineer somewhere. We're going to break something, right? They have no idea what they're doing. They're not equipped to do it. And it's a conflict of interest because now you have the entity. That's why you have a DOD in a State Department, is because you have military, the military side, and you have a diplomatic side. Those two sides exist for a reason, so you're hitting it from both angles. But now the diplomatic side has both control of the military and diplomacy. So they're negotiating with the Taliban, and they're controlling the NEO operation. So it creates a huge conflict of interest in a very dangerous scenario. So now the State Department takes the United States military and treats them just like embassy guards. They took HKA Airport, Hazid Karzai International Airport, the airport in Kabul that we're all trying to get out of. They took that airport, made it like an embassy. They made it like an embassy, like to where you have security guards, which would be our military. And if you can make it onto the embassy, you can make it onto the airport, you're safe. But if you can't, no one's coming to help you. There's no rescue operations anymore. If the military sees an American citizen being harmed outside that perimeter, then they're not going to be able to help them. And meanwhile, military men and women are having to watch the British, the French, the Germans go rescue people, but we're not allowed to because the State Department didn't allow it. And then we said to the American public, and the White House has said to the American public, that we controlled the airport. We never controlled that airport. The hostage situation of Americans began on about August 22nd when we gave the Taliban the outer perimeter of that airport. Anybody that knows military strategy knows that if you control the outer perimeter, you control that ground space.
Yeah.
And we gave that outer perimeter to the Taliban and made them the first checkpoint for people coming in. So now the Taliban, in coordination with the State Department, was checking blue passports. They were checking documents. And in fact, if America made it past, on many occasions, this is not hearsay, this is firsthand testimony, they make it to the airport, even inside the airport in a holding area, they were being put out, sent back out to go in line and do it the correct way by showing their blue passports to the Taliban. And we know firsthand, the Taliban was taking the passports away from them, sending them home, beating them up, in some cases with SIV, our allies, killing them right there in the streets.
Yeah.
As that word got out.
And this is firsthand accounts.
This is firsthand accounts.
Because you were there.
So it's firsthand accounts. This isn't like me, hearing this on the news or anything like that. So now Americans know this is happening. So Americans are frozen in place. I mean, imagine, like, if you're an Afghan American, dual citizen, or your heritage is Afghan, and you lose that blue passport, you get taken from you, you know you're never, ever getting out of there.
Yeah. That's the, and the way it works in the Middle East, which this whole process is just dumb to me.
Yeah.
Because the way it works in the Middle East is like everything via paperwork. If you don't have that piece of paper
with a stamp,
gotta have that stamp. Then it doesn't exist.
Right.
So if you don't have that paperwork, and then you go to the CENTCOM commander in a press conference literally stated, and I'm paraphrasing here, that the Taliban are running the outer perimeter and we're working with them to make sure we don't have these inefficiencies in getting people through them. This is after ISIS made it through a Taliban checkpoint and killed 160 plus Afghans and 13 Americans. And you see all this transpiring, and it's almost like, dude, this could be a very good movie because it's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
And like it's happening.
Like a fiction movie.
It's a fiction. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like the grossest fiction movie of all time. And I mean, you're calling it out live.
Especially when the White House says, whoever did that V-bid or, blew these people up, we're going to retaliate. We're going to make them pay. Okay. The Taliban's going to be your JTAC, right? The Taliban's going to be the JTAC to get the target. I said either one, they're going to blow up an empty building to show they did something.
Yep.
Or two, there's going to be civilians in that building.
And there were
sure
civilians.
Enough, there was 11 that we know of, 11 Afghan civilians in that building.
Yeah.
And I mean, so who gave the target? Our U.S. troops wasn't out there.
Yeah.
Who gave the target for that building? The Taliban? Like,
yeah.
I mean, or the Taliban control U.S. ordnance now?
It's so crazy, man.
We didn't allow foreigners to...
Well, what's bizarre, what's been bizarre world to me is seeing the reporting on it from all of the left liberal media that are like, I can't navigate what their position on anything is anymore because it's so inconsistent. But now all of a sudden it's like, it's a good thing we're pulling out. And now all of the citizens and everything, nobody's saying anything about the circumstance. Nobody's reporting on hostages behind enemy lines. Nobody's reporting on the catastrophe that this is. Nobody's pointing fingers at Biden. And you're like, how is this possible? It's a humanitarian crisis.
Yeah. I mean, on a biblical level, like this is what's going to happen to these women? I mean, you just immediately had 20 million women sex slaves created, yeah. And no one cares about it. Look, I mean, show you the priority of the Taliban. The very first thing they announced when they start taking over, like they didn't announce anything else. It was about the women.
Yeah.
All the imams, basically all the mayors, we need a list of everybody, of every woman between 15 and 45.
Yeah.
Give us a list because we're going
to, they're going to go pick out and shoot, recruit.
Yeah, we're going to pick out and choose, and we're going to, you know, these guys, these war fighters are going to get their wives, and then we're going to send women back to the madrasas to get re-educated. That was the first thing. That's the most important thing to him. Where are the feminists like in this? Like, where's the White House in this? I mean, it's insane to me. And then, you know, the children, like, I mean, my heart was broken for these children. We were going after 3,000 orphans. I mean, we ended up getting 700 of them, but you know, we were 2,300 short of how many we want to get. And everybody's like, it's kind of hard for us because everybody's telling us, oh, great job. You guys did a great job. You got 700 orphans. I'm like, man, go in our jock and see the target list that are scratched off that we didn't get. Yeah. You know,
So you get to a point now where you're going to action this. You work with the UAE, you're getting all of your logistics, your jock, Joint Operations Center set up. And then, the call gets, out to guys, some of those guys, Tim Kennedy, who's obviously been working with you. What was the plan from there? What was your strategy in going in to navigate this, especially dealing with military, State Department, all of these things that were going on?
Yeah. I mean, you know, one, we wanted to make sure we do everything as right as possible. I mean, we're committed to do it, but we want to do it right. And when I say right, I mean, legal, you have to work with the military, and to be legal, and you have to, you know, there's certain laws. You have to do it. We're a nonprofit, so the money we're funding this through is through our nonprofits. We wanted to make sure all that was right. And one thing we wanted to make sure was most important for us to be right is that we got the right people out. And so we kind of sent a distress signal to, you know, through social media and through our networks that we were going to be doing this. And we thought we'd get a couple hundred, like we got 29,000 people that said they needed help.
Yeah. That were in Afghanistan.
That were in Afghanistan.
That responded through your website or through your email chain, yeah. And were like, I need help.
Yep. Americans, SIVs, people in new orphan groups, like Christian schools, like, you know, humanitarian workers, aid workers, all this stuff. You know, people were like, why'd they stay till the end? I mean, these are people, why'd they stay till the end? Because they trusted the White House that said this wasn't going to happen. They were told they had time. They weren't given the warning that they needed to be given. And they were like, they had a job to do there. They went vacationing there. They were like aid workers and school teachers. So they were there for a legitimate reason. And they thought they would stay as long as they could because they care. And so these people are now trapped and they're sending out help, you know, requests for help for us. SIVs and stuff. So we knew we had to be responsible with who we were going to get out. We didn't want to be just bringing out anybody just for the sake of racking up numbers. Numbers aren't impressive. Like, quality is very important.
Yeah.
And something like this. And so we had this lady, Sarah from, the Independence Fund. She's the CEO of the Independence Fund. She did an amazing job. She took charge of really building this master list, and triaged it. So she took all the emails and all the requests we got, and she categorized, SIV applicants, American citizens, P1 visas, P2 visas, orphans, widows, or women that would be in a vulnerable group. Particularly like the educated women or journalists and things like that. And then Christians, because we knew Christians were going to be persecuted, targeted, and killed. So we built these triage lists. They kind of got triaged by how much paperwork and validation they had, and how vulnerable they were. And then also, you know, our availability of where we were geographically to be able to help them. And then, we had that up running in the States. We had our jock in Abu Dhabi. We had put one guy on the ground at HKIA airport to go in, make friends with the military right away. And luckily he had a former West Point colonel, super, very connected guy. And so he was able to be accepted by the military really quick, got a chair in their talk. That one of the problems that the military had was all these humanitarian efforts were trying to bring in tons of planes and the military just shut it down, said no planes. And so he went in and said, hey, let us handle this for you. Let us be the center point for all these commercial planes, and we'll help coordinate those for you. So only get one at a time. And so we were able to do that for the military.
So you guys proposed to the plane to fly the planes in, and then they shut it down. Because it wasn't coordinated through UAE?
Well, not just us, like tons of humanitarian efforts. Oh, yeah. We're trying to all fly there at one time, and they're like, it's just too chaotic. No. You know the military, like,
of course.
Too much chaos? No. The answer's just no. Instead of saying somebody coordinated it. So our guy was like, hey, let us help you out. We'll coordinate it all, and we'll make sure only one comes down at a time. Give us a ramp. So they gave us a ramp, and he coordinated those flights. So basically, we took control of all the commercial air that came on. So that's what our guy did. And this guy stayed up. I can't say his name, but he's just amazing. He stayed awake probably 24/7. Like
doing traffic control?
Pretty much traffic control for 10 days. And worked right there to talk in the military with the military. And so because of doing that for them, we were able to coordinate all of our air. And then we put three guys outside the wire. And the three guys outside the wire, can't say, who they were. We rotate it, by the way.
Yeah.
But I can't say some of the guys'
names. Deliberate rescue operations.
Yep. And I can't say, one of us, Tim was in the rotation. I can't say two of the other guys' names. Because of what they do now, but if they're listening, some of the most incredible human beings I ever met. One guy he's an fit guy too, lost 40 pounds in 8 days.
Wow.
Just running around, drinking water, eating bars, and running around. So what we did, how we coordinated it was that jock in the U.S. sent that main list to us. Our jock in Abu Dhabi, and I was a big part of this. Like, we started building, okay, this list, this is where our guys are. This list is 30 orphans here. There's a group of 20 women here. There's a group of SIVs and their families here. There's a underground church here. So we like coordinating all these pieces and essentially walking our team onto target packages and to rescue them. And then we want to make sure that it were who they said they were. So we had a bona fide system set up with a 7-point authentication system to make sure, I can't say them all for obvious reasons, but time, location. Had to be a match. Their documents had to be a match, and then we had some other near-4 type signals and passwords and stuff like that. We had to work with them on to make sure we had the right people, and then we either rat-lined them in through some gates I could say now there were some gates that everybody knows about, the Abbey Gate and North Gate, those big gates that we saw the crowds at. But we had some other gates that we were able to rat-line them through, and then at times we had some buses that our guys commandeered. We were able to just drive them in some bigger gates, but it got more and more complicated towards the end when the military started turning people away. We had a holding area. They started making, we had one incident, and I can't, because of legal things, there's an investigation going, but we had one incident where we had some military leadership, I gotta be careful what I say here, send Americans out, a couple hundred orphans out, and about 700 people that we had in the hold area, send them back out to the Taliban.
Yeah.
And,
I heard about that
too. Blue passport holders.
Yeah. And do you think that was done? Because when I hear that, it sounds like, emotion. It sounds like bad tactics through emotion. Like, I've seen people do it. I've seen generals do it. I've seen officers do it. I've seen, senior enlisted guys do it where they're like, I don't care. I don't care what's going on. Don't push them out. Right.
Yeah.
And it's hasty. Was it one of those deals?
It was one of those deals. I think it was a combination of the State
Department. Like egos.
The State Department gave us this direction and a set of rules, and what you have liberty to, when you're a military on the ground, in the military leadership, you could, there's some leeway there, right?
Yeah.
And, but
you can cooperate, collaborate, or you could just be a dick and just not get accomplished.
And the latter's what happened. And,
that's unfortunate, man.
It's very unfortunate, especially when you're talking about people's lives.
Yeah.
You're talking about Americans.
So I served with a 2-star that was on the ground there, and I wish I was there, man, because I got good rapport with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like if I was there in a conversation, this is obviously in hindsight and just wishing, I heard about that from Tim. And then I was like, dude, I know that dude. And I know if I just navigated a conversation with him, it would have been like, I won't even say his name, but I know him on a first name basis, and just be like, hey man, let's navigate this together. Yeah. There's a way, but now it's too late.
Yeah.
That hasty decision could have led to people's lives being lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you guys, let's talk through this piece, 'cause there's a controversial thing where there's a whole bunch of trolls on media saying, onesies and twosies were saying, you guys were getting in the way. This was not a collaborative effort. You guys were just cowboys. And I know because I understand how these kind of things work. If you don't have the logistics, the planning, the support, and it's not deliberate, it's not going to be successful. And you guys
allow it to happen. Anyway.
You guys didn't just commandeer an airplane in on the East Coast and fly it into Afghanistan.
Yeah. So those comments are so ridiculous. Yeah. It's like, what do you think? We just flew there. The military let us land and open the front gate and walk out with like AK-47s and go like fight the Taliban and get people. That's not at all what we did. First of all, no one on our team. It was one of my criteria. No one could have like a combatant mindset.
Yeah.
That's over. We did that already.
Yes.
That's not what we're here for.
Yeah.
We're not going to fight anybody. We could be as mad as we wanted the Taliban or what they're doing. That's not what vengeance cannot be part of it. It would strictly have to be humanitarian, helping people.
Yeah.
And two, like, you can't just land the aircraft on a military controlled airfield. You have to have permission.
Yeah.
And so they let us come there. They collaborated with us.
It makes sense now that it was through the UAE and that there was you were literally using host nation force C-17s to get people out.
We had a chair in the TOC. We coordinated all of our air with them. The United States military gave us a ramp, our own air ramp, and a holding center.
Yeah.
So this was not, it really made me mad when people went after Tim. But like, I love Tim. You love Tim, but you can not like Tim. That's fine.
Yeah.
But the dude, like, I asked him to come, first of all.
Yeah.
And he said yes. He didn't want any attention. He didn't want any money.
Yeah.
He took his own time out.
Yeah.
And he's the busiest human being.
He's busier than me, and I'm busy.
Yeah.
And he's just like, I'm up and I'm going.
He put his life at risk, and I didn't see one time that he did anything for like glory or
anything. No.
He wanted to help people, man. He's a good dude, and he wanted to help people. And it just really pissed me off to see people going after him when like they're sitting on their couch and he's out there, running outside the wire, like rescuing little kids. And if you don't like him, fine, but give the guy credit where credit's due.
Let's talk about that little controversy. Cause there was a thing where like Marines were taking picture or Marines were angry because he was bringing people through the gate. And then some people got left behind and all this crap. None of that was true. I talked to Tim through it and he's like, no, that's not what happened.
That's
at
not
all.
True. That's just people talking trash, man. That's not true.
Yeah.
Everything we did was coordinated.
Yeah.
Everything we did was coordinated. Now you might have been like some, line company Marine that's seen and like, who's doing this? You don't have the back behind. You don't have the perspective. Yeah. Like we're working with some of the soft guys. We're working with, the TOC directly. So if you're like a, 22 year old Marine standing perimeter, you're like, who's this guy? I could see that,
Yeah,
but that's just misinformation and not understanding the big picture. That's not, everything we did was completely coordinated. In fact, we have retroactive CENTCOM approval now.
Yeah.
You just don't get that, by the way.
So now, you spend 8 days on the ground and you're doing this. What is your, after spending that time on the ground, you having the perspective of having a lot of assumptions, then literally being on the ground, what is your sum up of everything that's taken place and how we move forward from it?
Well, for us, we left. And when we left, when I say we, the United States left. And when we left people behind. And I know without even mentioning it to you, you had the same mentality as me. Like, you don't ever leave an American behind.
Yeah.
And this is argument about how many, right? How many doesn't matter. But my number, and people think I've been saying this, people are like, what? That's not right, I've been saying there's probably at least 5,000 Americans still there, maybe like 20, 30,000 allies that we need to get out. That's the numbers that I kind of anticipate. And the reason I say that is I'm kind of going off the White House's numbers because they're the most conservative. They said we had 10,000 there. They said they pulled out 5,000. So I'm not a mathematician. I'm not, but 10,000 minus 5,000 is 5,000 left over, not 200.
Yeah.
But even if it's one, right? In the world you and I come from, if you have one American citizen behind in harm's way somewhere, it doesn't even matter if they're their fault, if they did something stupid.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to go.
We rescue dumbasses all the time.
Yeah. We're going to go
make
them.
Mistakes.
We'll freaking scorch the earth and use every bit of military might and resources to go get them. Even like, I've even seen like, at the command I was at, there was this British journalist and we were going to go in and get her from this, not even American, we're going to go get her from this, out of this Taliban village. And this, the way they had to fast rope in, and it's like, well, we're going to lose some guys. And they're like,
accept the risk.
Yeah.
Hell for one person.
Let's go. Okay, yeah. So, I mean, so it's unconscionable to me that we could leave even one behind, much less thousands.
Yeah.
And then the White House is like, they're on the next subject. Like, we still have Americans there. And you give a deadline, like the deadlines, you know, we shouldn't have been in this situation anyway, but now we are. You don't get a deadline and you don't negotiate it out. The deadline's when we get our people out. That's a deadline. But then we gave this deadline and now we left. And and then I see the Taliban's getting props because they flew a plane out.
I just was thinking that. Like, they gave props. The media gave props. They're like, oh, man, the Taliban are cool people because they let Americans out. Like, what?
They're not cool people. They want the $10 billion that is of assets that are frozen. It's the hostage situation. Like, if they'll let people out in exchange for that $10 billion. This is a ransom deal. This isn't like them being nice.
Yeah, this is negotiation with terrorists as per we're not supposed to be doing.
Yeah, it's not. So that, to answer your question, like, we know there's still people there. We still feel like we have some capacity to get people out. We have to kind of pause. There's some international laws that we don't want to break because we're not cowboys.
Yeah.
We'll make sure we do those right. We'll make sure we do at least risk possible and safely, safety for our team, safely for people who want to get out. And obviously I can't talk about how, but we still going to intend if you're there waiting. There's not just us. There's other people that still intend to go try to help get people out.
Yeah.
And so we plan on continuing to do that. Now there's this other side of the people that we already got out. Of the 12,000, we kind of have claimed responsibility for 8,911. That's the people we put hands on. That's who's in the humanitarian center. I have team.
They're in the humanitarian center in UAE.
In Abu Dhabi. I have staff there right now. By the way, my interpreter Aziz has become like the president of the humanitarian center. He's coordinated, really cool. Organized. He's like, hey, we need somebody in charge of this ward, somebody in charge of this ward, somebody in charge of each floor. You bring your request to them. They bring the request to me. He's helping the State Department coordinate and manage it all. One of the girls that was first girls that we rescued was she is English speaking, very good English speaking, master's in business. So she's handling the females. And so we're working hand in hand with the State Department. While there's a lot of bad things you can say about the overall State Department, how they handled this, the men and women on the ground in the State Department in Abu Dhabi have worked really well with our team. And in Albania, I flew a group to Albania and I met with the deputy ambassador of the Albanian embassy there. And just wonderful people that really care and want to help. So there's some great people out there in the process of doing this. But we want to make sure that our group that we took responsibility for get resettled, go from home that they lost to a new home. And that process includes like humanity, like being treated with dignity and respect, and especially these vulnerable women that are there by themselves. I mean, a lot of them have no one. They don't have anything on their back. Imagine, like, you have nothing on your back. Your family sent you because they didn't want you to be raped and killed. So now you're there by yourself. You know no one.
Yeah. And you said they had a backpack, and then a lot of them had their backpacks removed because there was not enough room on the plane.
Yeah. They just have nothing, and they don't have anyone. I met this little boy. He was 13 years old, and I could tell like he was just staring off. And he's funny because he's like you could tell he's like a kind of tough kid.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hey, it's funny how fast my daughter kind of came back. I'm trying to talk to him, and Aziz has helped me. And I'm like, you okay? You look kind of scared. He's like, I'm good. And I'm like, where's your family? And he said, they were trying to get through the crowd, him, his mom and all his brothers and sisters. And he was able to be ahead a little bit because he's a 13 kind of athletic kid. And Taliban started shooting and his family got separated and his dad just told him, go, we'll meet you inside. And they never made it in. And I'm like, what can I do for you? And he's like, I just want to call my mom and dad. So, so he didn't have a phone so we want to get phones to these people. And so that's one of our things on Amazon gift thing. If you go on my Instagram, Chad Robo_official, or just search my name, Chad Robo Show. And I'm the blue check one. So
that's, yeah, I'll put it in the notes on this too.
Go and on my, I have a link tree and you can click on the Amazon thing and you could donate supplies because we need to get like phones and clothes and for the girls and stuff like that. So they're not wearing the same thing and we just need help. And we've already got like 4,000 packages. And so we're getting that stuff directly to these people. I let him call his mom and dad. They just got a voicemail, but he left a message letting them know he's okay.
Oh, but, man. But he doesn't know their status.
He didn't know their status. And he doesn't know where he's gone. He doesn't know anything. I mean, imagine being a 13-year-old boy, like you have nothing. You don't know one. You don't know immigration system or anything. You don't even speak the language. Like it's a terrible situation. And so for us, there's the rescue side still. And as the resettlement side, we want to make sure that, again, there's dignity, respect, and just a love and care, like from a human level, for these people till they get to a new home. And so we committed as an organization to do that. When I say as an organization, to saveourallies.org, that's what we committed to doing.
Okay.
And by the way, like, that's one of the things that really captured me about Tim, because everybody knows Tim for being like, you know, rough kind of caveman dude. But Tim's like, I seen a soft side of Tim that I hadn't seen before in this, man. His heart, like, for these kids, and mine too. I mean, that's like, you know, it's kind of what it's been pushing us, is the heart for these kids and these vulnerable people. And just to, me and Tim went to Albania together, and you know, to drop off the first group in Albania, and you know, we just kind of talked a lot and got to see, you know, his heart for these people.
Yeah. What's going to become of the all the people that you rescued? Are any of them going to be able to come to America?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think the SIVs will. It'll be a long process because, man, they never intended to get those people out. So there wasn't a process in place for it.
Yeah.
So it'll be probably a long process for the SIVs. I think the first group we'll get to America is the orphans.
Well, if they just fly to Mexico, they could just walk across the border.
Yeah, walk across. We'll give them sombreros and they could just walk across.
That's it. It's insane. It's
yeah.
crazy.
Or give them a backpack full of cocaine and they'd walk
yeah.
right in.
Yeah, get a mule right and you'll be good.
Yeah.
So what's the future for, cause things have changed and you've been shaped by these events. And I imagine structure wise with Save Our Allies, your mission's going to change.
Yeah. I mean, Mighty Oaks Foundation is, you know, cause you're an advisor on the board of Mighty Oaks. Like, we have a very clear mission to help, you know, the active duty military, spouses, veterans, and first responders who are dealing with veteran suicide, PTSD, just different life issues. We do resiliency programs. I've spoken to over 250,000 people in our resiliency programs. I'm based around the world. We have our recovery programs. We do 35 camps a year. I've had 4,000 people go through, but I have about 1,000 people go through moving forward per year. And we do that all for free. It's about $3.5 million a year of programming. And we pay for flights and everything. So any veterans listening, especially those affected by this, and you know, many Afghan veterans right now are really affected by this. Like, yeah. Maybe they didn't get their interpreter out, or they're feeling like, what did I lose my buddy for? I lose my legs for? I lose my mind for? Like, was it for nothing? You know, one, I tell you, it's not for nothing, because one, we accomplished what we went there for after 9/11. We did do that. And two, like, even with what we did for Afghanistan, we gave them 20 years. There's girls that got educations because we were there.
Yeah.
There's people that have, you know, there's people that have hope. There's, you know, these 12,000 people that we got out.
Yeah.
You know, they, you know, we did that for them, and so we didn't do it for nothing. But I understand it can be hard. And so at Mighty Oaks, you know, we come to our program, you go to mightyoaks.org and get help there. You know, for Save Our Allies, we're probably going to break off to a separate 501c3, because it's actually, it's bigger than we thought it was. It's bigger than me going get Aziz now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a long road to resettle these 12,000 people, or 8,900 that we claimed. And we got a long road ahead of us to continue to rescue people. We're going to continue those efforts to rescue people. And so, you know, it's, Tim's going to be on the board. So me and Tim and Nick and Sarah from Independence Fund, we're all going to build this. We're going to need a lot of help, financially. So it's a place you could go donate at saveourallies.org. Mm. You could help with that, that Amazon, gifts also, to get packages to people. Main thing we need is, but we definitely need financial support, because we raised about close to $2 million so far between our international fund at Mighty Oaks and the Save Our Allies campaign. But you know, the heavy lift is just beginning, and it's to be a long haul. So we definitely need support there, prayer. And you know, we could be leaning on people like you, Mike, to, you know, as we move forward in these operations. I mean, I know a lot of people, but I have a small circle of people I trust in this kind of stuff. And you're one of them. And you know, so we'll be leaning on you.
Yeah. I want to be involved, man. So here's what I'm thinking. So I just got the approval for a documentary with Black Rifle Coffee on the Iraqi counterterrorism force. And we're having country issue problems with trying to get visa approval to go into that country for obvious reasons. A lot of these countries there's issues, the State Department, whether it's the State Department, diplomatic issues, whatever. But we should do a documentary on the Afghan situation, but through you guys is the optic, right? So I would need permission to fly to the UAE. Maybe we can go together and then interview you.
Some of the humanitarian, like people at the humanitarian.
Tim, the humanitarian guys, some of the UAE generals. My whole thing, like, this is not an effort. There's no money to be made, by the way, in these kind of efforts. The whole thing is through Black Rifle's grace and giving me allocated budgets to do these documentaries. The idea is to bring exposure to issues like this that affect veterans, that affect people. And this is the most significant thing that people want to turn the page on. Politicians want to turn the page on specifically because it's tainted them. And they're like, oh, let's just move on to the next thing because then we'll forget about the shit stain that this circumstance is. This is still ongoing.
Yeah.
And I want as much exposure on this issue as possible.
I mean, it can't go away because, I mean, one, the international community is furious at the United States.
Yeah.
And I don't just mean like people in the Middle East. I mean, like our, like Britain, like countries.
Yeah,
like, I mean, cause the whole world is a more dangerous place right now.
Yeah.
You have the greatest terrorism regime in the world today. The Taliban is now partnered with ISIS, is now partnered with by proxy China and Iran. They have $85 billion in U.S. military equipment. They're all synergized in the most strategic location that can be on the planet. And, you know, and it's just the world's become a much more dangerous place.
Yeah,
and it can't go away.
And this idea that the Taliban's going to be targeting ISIS, like, dude, if you don't know the origin story of the Taliban is the orphans displaced from the Russian incursion, the Russian invasion.
Yeah,
all the Taliban were children and young men that fled to Pakistan as orphans and started their Islamic led, you know, faith-based organization in Pakistan with Pakistani support, and then influxed and fought wars with Ahmad Massoud and fought wars against the Northern Alliance and fought wars against the communist government of Afghanistan when it was instilled in Bagram and Kandahar and in Kabul. And they have been trying to institute extremist ideology since the beginning.
Yeah.
And these guys are the guys who have fought side by side terrorist organizations, killed Americans, and we've been at war with them. This is not a repatriated group or organization of human beings that are like, now they're good. I mean, if you saw the guys that came out of the hinterlands and were standing in the presidential palace of Afghanistan in Kabul, it's like, dude, these dudes have no clue.
Yeah.
I mean, they're unconventional indigenous insurgents,
right,
that are now trying to be diplomatic. That doesn't happen.
It's not going to happen. You know, I wish there'd be people in Washington, D.C. that read history books I mean, I think a lot of people don't know that, you know, Ahmad Massoud was assassinated right before 9/11 by Osama bin Laden brilliantly because he knew that we would need him as an ally. And
September 10th.
Yeah. So he killed them the day before, 9/11, to cut off our allies, in advance, cause he knew we were going after them. And so all these years later, 20 years later, you see Ahmad Massoud's son has just risen up, and is leading the Northern Alliance again. And the Panjshir Valley, which we know the Panjshir Valley as a kind of, as a totality, has just fallen, 3 days ago. But there's still little pockets of resistance. Northern Alliance is there. And so, you know,
did Panjshir fall?
Panjshir as the valley has fell. Yeah. There's still pockets of resistance there. And, you know, Ahmad Massoud is still leading those. And, you know, but we, you know, the United States government this time is not going to be getting behind Northern Alliance to fight the Taliban. We're supporting the Taliban.
What do you think? I know you got to catch a plane. I want to talk about just real quickly. What do you think, based on the administration and having 3.5 more years of this, what do you think the future for America is going to be?
Man, it's so rapid. It was kind of like when Obama was in office. There was a very rapid just tearing down of who America is, and we're seeing that kind of play out now.
Yeah.
But they did that kind of in secret.
Yeah.
And now it's in plain sight. And now it's just so bold. Like what, you know, President Biden said yesterday about the, you know, 80 million people that'll be exposed to vaccine mandates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have, I think they gave 75 days for every federal employee.
Yeah.
They have military people. I sent you a video earlier. They have
Secretary of Defense.
I think 12 F-22 pilots.
Yeah. 12 F-22 pilots.
Yes.
Yeah.
Resigned.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to get the jab and that's just one, like, that's just one squadron.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, you gotta think with how long it takes to train F-22 pilots, you know, millions of dollars and thousands of flight hours. And, And you don't just replace someone like that when you have 12 leave at one time. I mean, the military is very calculated. That's why you give a huge re-enlistment bonus to these people. And that's just one, like, so we're going to lose, what we're losing in the federal government, in the military, is not just these incredible people. When you really think about it, who are you losing is the people who would stand up for themselves. What you left with is people who will say yes without question to the federal government.
Oh yeah.
And that is a dangerous thing.
Yeah, it's scary.
Because now you have a military and you have a federal government that is willing to do anything and everything, even when it's not morally right.
Yeah.
And it's a scary place. And I think that these vaccine mandates will not make it past the Supreme Court, but the boldness for the White House to do that. And by the way, the White House doesn't even make, that's not a mandate for their staff.
Their own staff. And they're condescending about it. That's what's bizarre to me. It's like, you're standing on the pulpit and you're an elected official representing Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you talk down to Americans like somehow we're children. He's communicating to America like we're children. And this, the whole idea that we somehow need to be like, the fact that you're mandating the healthiest population in our society, the military. That literally have the ability, because all of their health records, their immunizations for legitimate things, and then you're taking that away, and you're willing to compromise the force that you operate in because of your ideology, radical ideology, is bizarre to me.
For a virus that has, a 99.9% survival rate.
Yeah,
it's much more complications with the vaccine, it's. I mean, we could get in a whole nother podcast on that, but it's not even a vaccine and no one knows what it is. And it's just, I'm not anti-vax. I'm anti this, because I don't know what it is, but I'm not an anti-vax person.
Well, my thing is, I'm not an anti-vax vaccine at all, but I'm also somebody who's already had COVID.
Right.
And it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
So I've had RSV recently, and RSV was to me twice as worse, like fever wise. I felt like I was dying. I couldn't breathe. I went to the ER three times a month ago with RSV, and there's no immunization.
Right.
So when you talk about, like, when I hear people going, there's record rates, I'm going, that doesn't matter to me. That's actually a good thing, because that's called herd immunity.
Yeah.
Those people are recovering. Tell me what the death statistics are. And the media doesn't want to talk about that because it's low. And then I go, well, that's great that that their entire hospitals are full of people that are going to recover, because now they're immune. So then that means if you're in a spike, you won't continue to spike. You'll just lull off.
Unless you start pumping vaccine everyone, because then it creates variants.
Yeah. And then you get the variants, and then you get the boosters, and then
another variant.
And then the only thing you have is, I don't know what to think, so I'm just going to listen to what the government tells me to verbatim. And yeah. I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that, period. And like you said, it's another podcast, but the fact that this is happening, and we're only whatever months into this, 6 months into this, it scares the hell out of me, man.
I really think the timing of the mandatory vaccination is not coincidental to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they knew there'd be outrage in this, and people's focus would shift off of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
To this, and,
of course.
And, because I mean, Afghanistan is, they have to pull the rug over it.
Yeah.
Because,
of course. Yeah. I went to one of the Marines, Tahani, sergeant, that was killed. I went to her memorial in New Hampshire, or in, a small town in New Hampshire outside of Boston. And when you see that, and you see like people coming together at our old high school, and it's like super real.
Yeah.
And these people's lives are affected forever. And it's such a, like, the fact that the media, because they're controlling the narrative, the fact that the media hasn't even highlighted these 13 service members, Marines, a Navy corpsman, and a psychological operations Army guy, they haven't highlighted them. It's the largest casualty since 2011, but we're not talking or focusing on the fact that the decisions made by a political administration led to the direct deaths of 13 patriots. And that we're just assuming that that's a norm, or that's okay. And we're just bypassing it, and now it's on the new talking points?
They had the intel that the vehicle was coming.
Really?
Yeah, they had the intel.
Did you guys get the intel on the ground? Were you guys on the ground when that happened?
Tim and our two other guys had just left that gate.
Wow.
They were at the gate just a short time before.
Wow.
Yeah. That was a kind of a near miss. But
did we lose any American civilians, the contractors in that?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. So
I think like 65 Afghans and maybe 180 plus injuries.
Yeah. I know there's a lot of American injuries too, because a lot of guys, it was a mass casualty event, obviously.
Yeah.
And a lot of those guys are fighting for their lives and are going to be grossly affected forever.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a serious ID.
Yeah.
So
crazy, yeah. Man. All right. So where do we go? What's the links and where can people go to help?
Yeah. So saveourallies.org is where you can financially support, the effort, to continue to evacuate people, to resettle, these people. You get daily updates. I've been given daily updates for like 2 weeks now on my Instagram. I've been just shooting little videos out, and you can probably go back and listen to kind of as moved along through the process. You could also go there. I'll have a link in my link tree for the Amazon deal to support that way. And then, for Mighty Oaks Foundation, mightyoaksprograms.org, if a veteran is struggling and needs help, go there. You could also financially support Mighty Oaks there as well. So.
Awesome, man. Chad Robichaud, saveourallies.org and the Mighty Oaks Foundation.
Yep.
Thanks so much for being on the podcast.
You bet, brother. I'm glad I was able to be here.
Peace. Tip of the spear.